We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 205. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew number two, Andrew Torres. I'm sorry, our guest coming up, Andrew Seidel, has actually slipped into Andrew number one territory. I don't make the rules. It's how it goes. I don't know what, we can review the scoring system, but he is now Andrew number one. You are Andrew number two. Sorry about that, man. I feel bad.
Whenever we have Andrew Seidel on the show, I am happy to be the second best Andrew around. So,
looking forward to that. How's it going, Andrew Torres?
Oh, it's going well. We have an awful lot of things that have happened. We had a pretty eventful week last week, there's nothing yodely that is immediate that we have to get out this week. So I'd like to have us spend this episode do a little bit of a role reversal, right? So have this episode, we're going to do an interview with Andrew Seidel. We're going to talk about Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're going to talk about the recent Pennsylvania grand jury report on the Catholic Church, which is just horrifying. And we're going to talk about the latest masterpiece lawsuit in more depth, which we promised our listeners. There are a ton of yodel-worthy things. We've got updates on Paul Manafort. We have the latest developments on the 3D printed guns case. There's that potential for a Thomas Was Right segment.
That's so funny. So, I see that in the notes. I have no idea what that's about, but I'll assume, once you tell me, I'll be like, oh yeah, I was definitely right about whatever
right.
that
yeah.
was.
Take all that credit. And then the big one, probably 100 people emailed us this week to ask us about an article. I think it started in the Raw story. It was picked up, I think, in Politico and The Hill. Is there a sleeper case that is going to completely derail the Mueller investigation? We will find out. We will let you know, but we will let you know on Tuesday if that's okay with you, Thomas.
I don't know how I'm going to cope, but I guess, you know how I'll cope. I'm going to be looking forward to that. But I'm even more looking forward to speaking with Andrew Seidel right now about the bigotry baker, the masterpiece who just can't stop not baking cakes for people, and also the awful Catholic Church. So that's how I'll cope.
There you go.
And then we'll be very excited for Tuesday's episode. But only other announcement is that Q&A is coming at you real fast. Andrew's got some traveling to do, so it's a little late. Sorry about the scheduling, but we are going to do the patron Q&A. And by the way, that's open to everybody, but patrons are the ones who get to ask the questions. That's at patreon.com/law. That will be at 2:30 Pacific. That's 5:30 for everybody who matters, apparently. 5:30 Eastern time, Wednesday the 5th. So that's 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, Wednesday the 5th. That's the live Q&A video that everybody can come. With that said, what do you say we get over to our good buddy Andrew Seidel?
Yeah, let's get to it.
And we're joined by the who's got the most SNL? It's got to be like Steve Martin or something. We're joined by the Steve Martin
it's either Steve Martin or Tom Hanks. Yeah.
It's the Steve Martin of Opening Arguments. as everybody calls him, Andrew Seidel. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going well. Thanks again for having me on, guys.
It is a pleasure to have you, as always. And we are going to, we got a lot to talk about. We've got the Catholic Church. We've got there's some news has happened in the world since last you were here. But I think first off, we're going to be talking, we're back to the Masterpiece Cake Shop again, it seems. Are we ever going to hear enough about this Masterpiece Cake Shop? Could one cake shop doing so much harm?
I mean, one would certainly hope so, but this case is popping back up because of what we were talking about back in June. You know, we said that the Supreme Court blew it. They punted on these important issues when they could have stood on legal principle and said, you know, sorry, you don't have a religious right or a free speech right to violate the civil rights laws. You know, we made this clear in the Bob Jones case and the Piggy Park case and Employment Division v. Smith. And even back in this 1878 case, U.S. v. Reynolds, believing that your God is a bigot doesn't give you a license to act on that bigotry. Obey the law. The court could have done that, and instead it punted, and that is why we are seeing this case come back up again, and we're going to see actually a lot more would be, I think, a pretty safe prediction like this.
So on August 15th, the owner, Jack Phillips, the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop, filed a complaint against the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, right? So, and we talked about this and said we were going to have you on to kind of dig into the weeds on this. So you can go back and listen to our prior OA for the basics of what this cake is about. This is the refusal to make a two-toned cake.
A biracial cake.
Andrew, I mean... Yeah. Oh gosh.
Oh man.
I mean, one of the things. Maybe this is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about on this show is the importance of the fact pattern characterization as that goes up the chain, right? Because ultimately, you know, the unresolved question on compelled speech is at some point headed back to the Supreme Court, right? And so my kind of instant take on this is I wouldn't mind, you know, this is something you said off the air right before we started. If we lose on this case, and by we, I mean those of us who believe that the First Amendment does not enshrine a right to bigotry on the basis of religious beliefs that allows you to refuse to comply with neutrally applicable laws regarding public accommodation and serving the public. If we lose on this case, right, you know, we've lost on everything. I mean, I think that the facts here are pretty hard to describe as a hardship. But what do you think about that?
I think the facts are overall pretty good. I think we could probably invent better facts if we so desired, which, you know, I mean, this does appear to be a test case, you know, an individual going into the bakery to test whether or not it's going to comply with civil rights laws, which is historically very, very common. So you'd think they could have maybe done a little bit better job, like maybe recorded the phone call that they had with the bakery or something like that. I mean, so this is, I think it's fairly basic. This is a transgender woman named Autumn Scardina called up the Masterpiece Cake Shop, the bakery of bigotry, and asked to bake asked for a custom made cake that was blue and pink. So blue icing and pink on the inside, or do I have, I might have that backwards, pink on the outside, blue on the inside. Either way, she said that this was for her birthday. So basically this was a birthday cake with color preferences. And she also happened to mention that her birthday coincided with her gender transition that she would also be celebrating. And at that point, the bakery, it was the co-owner, it was Jack Phillips's wife, said, actually, we won't make that for you. Scardina called back and said, hey, I got cut off and I'm trying to get this cake made. And I guess she was hung up on again. So she went ahead and filed a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, the director of that, found probable cause that there was a violation of the civil rights statute in Colorado because it also protects gender identity there. So gender and gender identity are protected classes under the Colorado Civil Rights Statute. So, I mean, I think that's probably the most basic rundown. Andrew, do you want to add anything? Did I miss something important?
No. I think that that's a good summary. And so, you know, the important thing is what happened next is after Autumn filed her complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, the that commission determined that there was probable cause to believe that that Masterpiece had violated the anti-discrimination ordinance, which again, you know, I really appreciate your clarification on that. Right, we've talked about how in many states, neither sexual orientation nor gender identity are protected classes. Right, in 29 out of 50 states, they're not. In Colorado, they are, right? And that's the citizens came forward and democratically said, we do not want to discriminate against trans people. We do not want to discriminate against gay people in the state in businesses that serve the public. And so the commission said, yeah, we think there is probable cause to believe that you've violated the statute. And, you know, a part of why I feel like the facts are really good this time around in this case are that, you know, the commission, right, ordered them to mediation. Right? I mean, this is not, you know, it's going to be really hard for Jordan Peterson to talk about like jackbooted thugs, you know, overturning the shelves in the bakery. Right? Like it said, come on, go figure this out. We can work this out. And, you know, in compelled speech cases, to me, right, that seems like such an eminently reasonable place to begin, right? Not, you know, presumptively there's a bright line here, but just she's asking you for a cake that has two colors on it. And are you really telling me you're not going to serve her because she's trans?
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely
right.
And I'll
say yes.
If there's, and I think you touched on something that we should definitely get into, the procedure, but I think it is worth reiterating, right? This is just, it's just a two-toned cake. It's a birthday cake with color preferences. It doesn't really matter what the customer was planning on doing with it. It was a cake with colors that was to be eaten. You know, if she hadn't mentioned her gender transition coinciding with her birthday, the Bakery of Bigotry would have sold her the cake, right? I think that makes it pretty clear that they rejected her based on her status as a transgender woman. So that's discrimination. And that's illegal. And actually, you know, again, the strength of the facts here, you could even argue that it's worse here because a birthday cake is almost by definition a celebration of that person, right? So therefore, refusing to bake that cake is necessarily a rejection of that person. So I think, as you said, you know, the facts are kind of strong here. And just we should state, however ridiculous, the religious reason for the rejection, which is, quote, the idea that a person's sex is anything other than an immutable God-given biological reality. That idea is completely offensive.
Did they quote the chapter and verse on that one? I've read the entire Bible.
There are quite a few Bible citations in the complaint.
What is there's none of there nowhere in that Bible that I've read the entire thing of is there anything about trans people? Like, do they just stretch? What do they do the thing where they just find something that means something else and they say that it means that there are exactly two genders or something? Like what?
Oh yeah, what's that called? Religion? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
No. Well, okay. Well, so, wait, real quick, let me just say can I say my favorite line from the complaint?
Yes.
It's so bad. I love it so much. It's so terrible. Quote, Masterpiece Cake Shop is not just a bakery. It is an art gallery of cakes. Right? No, it's not. No, you're not. You're a bakery. You're a bakery of bigotry. Just get over yourself. Anyway.
Oh, that's good.
Look, I mean, I want to give a tiny bit of voice to that, right? Like Alicia Cook, our intrepid, one of the moderators in the OA community. I mean, she makes unbelievable cakes, right? I mean, for her son, she made this Minions cake that was just, I mean, it seemed to defy the laws of physics, right? Like, so, you know, I don't want us to overly make fun of bakers who can engage in artistic expression. And I want to say, I mean, I don't know why I'm trying to be as fair to bigots as possible, but like if you went into the cake shop and said, I want you to put, quote, there are only two, right? Yeah, like, you know, and have a lengthy manifesto on the cake, right? Like, I get that, right? Like, that can move into the realm of compelled speech, which in any rational society, that's the debate we should be having, right? Like, where is the intersection between compelling you to speak and your requirement to serve the public neutrally and equally? This is about a two-colored cake, and yeah. and the complaint kind of puts first, you know, front and center the endorsement argument. So, you know, I mean, at least in my view, at least it's framed correctly here, right? Like if any court were to adjudicate this on the merits, there really is no speech going on, right? It really is, I don't want to sell this to this person who is a member of this group who's going to use it in this celebratory way. And, you know, that the link between that and speech seems awfully tenuous to me.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, the participation argument is not as strong here either. You know, a wedding is often and historically a very religious event. You have a better argument that if you are religious, you know, you're participating in this religious event even by baking a cake. I don't think it's a good argument, but your argument is better than when you're talking about just a birthday cake. So I think you're right to say that the facts all in all here are considerably stronger.
But I think I was dropping a little hint in that evaluation. I think it's possible that no court ever evaluates this on the merits. What do you think?
That's a virtual certainty. I'd be surprised if at least anytime soon.
So we're gonna get a decision from, you know, the Kavanaugh court here.
It'll never go that far. No. It won't go that far.
We'll get a decision from the court that's like, oh, well, we're going to look at this, but the form you filled it out wrong. It's going to be some nonsense way to get out of actually adjudicating it. Is that what we're going to have?
Well, that's what we should have. We should have it because of the way that the bakery has brought this case. They did not let it go through the appropriate state civil rights procedure before taking it to the federal courts. And that is, if the federal courts are consistent with their precedent, that is a no-no. It's kind of interesting because basically the Colorado Civil Rights Commission essentially started everything over. You know, if they could have treated Phillips like, they could have treated the bakery like a repeat offender, if they thought their injunction was still in force, and they could have said, you know, you're in contempt of court or something along those lines. They could have avoided going after him at all if they thought they had lost everything in the Masterpiece Cake Shop. Instead, they basically just started everything from the beginning. So you had Scardina complain to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. The next step is the director of that commission has to find whether or not there's probable cause that the bakery violated the public accommodations law. And that was that's the only thing that has happened in this case. The director, not even the full commission, said, yep, you know, I think there's probable cause here. So then it went to she ordered mediation for it. After mediation, if mediation failed, it would have gone to the full Colorado Civil Rights Commission, which is now all new people, none of the same people that were sitting on it. Then the Colorado Civil Rights Commission can file a complaint with an administrative law judge. Then that can go to the Colorado Court of Appeals, then to the Colorado Supreme Court, then to the U.S. Supreme Court. So instead of going through all of that process, the Bakery of Bigotry sued right after the probable cause finding, very, very early in the process. And it filed a 50-plus page complaint, which was kind of amazing. And the big procedural hurdle for the bakery here is this 1986 Supreme Court case called Ohio Civil Rights Commission v. Dayton Schools, 477 U.S. 619, for anybody that wants to go look it up. And the facts are nearly identical. And basically what it says is the Supreme Court said, you know what, we should not weigh in on these cases yet. And it's sort of this famous younger abstention. I don't know how much do you want to get into it, Andrew? I can go over all of it.
Oh, I love going down the younger abstention rabbit trail. I mean, this was one of the questions that was asked of I'm drawing a blank on the Trump nominee who had, you know, never tried a case and came out. And FFRF opposed him, right? So and he was withdrawn. So you guys did good work on that. But one of the questions was a question about this particular doctrine, right, called Younger abstention. And this is the way to think about it if you're a non-lawyer is that this is kind of a second cousin to standing, right? This is another way of looking at procedurally what's happening and saying, we're not ready to take this case yet, and we may never be ready to take this case. So this is a doctrine that is kind of a second cousin to standing, right? It's a procedural way for a court to say, we're not going to rule on this question. And remember that federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, right? You can go to a state court for anything, but federal courts are looking for reasons not to take their case. And one of them is this 1971 case called Younger versus Harris. And the idea is that a federal court should abstain from intervening in a case if it's brought by somebody who has a pending state court matter, and it began, the Younger case began with a pending state criminal court matter, right? So the idea is you have pending state proceedings, and in those state proceedings, you can raise your constitutional civil rights challenges. And in the Younger case, the Supreme Court said, if that's the case, then the federal courts ought to abstain. They ought not to take that case. They should let the state court adjudicate everything. And the reason for that is because, you know, it's sort of, this is why I said it's a second cousin to standing, is because that way they may never have to decide the constitutional question, right? If the state proceeding is resolved on some other grounds, then you don't have to raise your constitutional questions. And so, you know, you don't have to decide what could be an optional kind of constitutional question. And then in 1986, as Andrew points out, that was explicitly extended to administrative proceedings and to administrative proceedings involving religious institutions.
Well,
who were making claims.
And even better than that. I mean, I think the case is it's almost identical. It's really close to right on point. Like if we read the facts, it sounds familiar. You know, this is a private school that asserted free exercise and establishment clauses of the First Amendment, saying that the commission couldn't punish it, this religious school, for engaging in employment discrimination. Okay, I mean that's.
Oh, and let's. I mean, why don't you talk a little bit about the woman?
Oh, yes, it's ridiculous.
If this doesn't get the bile in the back of your throat.
Okay, so the underlying allegation in the case is also all about the Bible. A teacher got pregnant. Okay, not out of wedlock, just as a wife and a soon-to-be mother, and she told the principal, and the principal informed her that her contract would not be renewed at the end of the school year because Dayton, that's the name of the school, religious doctrine that mothers should stay home with their preschool-age children. Okay, so the Bible says, you're a woman, you gotta stay home. So she sued, she went to the Ohio Civil Rights Commission alleging sex discrimination. And while that was going on, the school filed in federal court. And this eventually went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, hey, Younger abstention, right? The state administrative proceedings are in which, you know, there's important state interests being vindicated. We're not going to step in until we have to. And so, to me, that case is almost right on point. I don't see how Masterpiece gets around it. I know what they're going to argue, but I don't think a court's going to buy it.
So what do you think?
I agree with you. Tell me what you think they're going
to
argue. Yeah.
So there is an exception to the Younger abstention. There's a couple, but the one that would apply that I think if you're Masterpiece, you'll argue is that the proceedings in the Colorado Civil Rights Commission amount to a pattern of harassment. And if you read the complaint, that seems to be the argument that they are bolstering in advance. They're essentially arguing that the state of Colorado, I think the word they used was on a crusade to get Jack Phillips. You know, they're really out to, they're just hostile to his religion, and they're going to do whatever it takes to stop him from, I don't know, baking cakes, but that's the opposite of what they're trying to do. So to force him to bake cakes, I don't really know where they're going with it, but that would be my prediction.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And it would surprise me, right? Let's play this out. The way in which this is going to take place is August 15 is when Phillips filed his complaint. Colorado is going to move to dismiss that complaint. They're going to move to stay or dismiss on the younger abstention grounds. And I think they're certainly going to win at the district court level because you're applying precedent. I think they're going to win at the Eighth Circuit level. But we could see procedurally. Andrew, oh, yeah, is it 10? I'm sorry. 10. They're going to win at the Tenth Circuit. And then the question is, could we see this case procedurally get up to the Supreme Court? Do you think there is any reason that the current Supreme Court or the current Supreme Court plus Brett Kavanaugh would want to revisit younger abstention in this case? Or do you think that they're likely to just affirm what the Tenth Circuit is, in my view, is very likely to rule?
Well, I mean, if they're doing what they should do, you know, excluding
right. But I specifically said the Supreme Court with Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah,
I
think that's a much harder calculus. You know, I mean, if the commission is successful on limiting the case to the younger abstention and whether or not there's this pattern of harassment against this guy, which I think is just ridiculous. So, you know, we talked about how the hostility in the initial case was manufactured anyway. I think they're gonna have a very hard time under any Supreme Court, no matter how hostile, saying that the younger abstention should all of a sudden go away under this, because it is procedural and it's not saying we're never going to reach this question about whether or not you have a free speech or free exercise right to discriminate. It's saying we're not looking at that now because we don't have to. And I mean, I think that makes sense. And it also goes with the idea that the Supreme Court punted in the initial Masterpiece Cake Shop case. But then again, now you have a new court. So you're kind of back.
But okay, that all makes sense. Except I still want to know, pretend they are going to, you know, pretend the worst case for people like us, which is they are going to carve out this exception or whatever it is. What are they even saying then? They're saying because somebody was mean to you, then you get one free discrimination again? Is that what it's going to be? Like, what even would be the result of getting this exception somehow to younger abstention?
Well, so the scary version would be they would say younger abstention doesn't apply, and we're going to go ahead and decide that bakeries have a right based in religion to discriminate against LGBTQ people in this case. So it would actually, the scary version is younger doesn't apply, and then the court goes on to redefine and weaponize religious freedom and completely alter that right in the way that we've been talking about for.
Well, I guess the point I'm making is the younger abstention thingy is really just delaying the inevitable anyway, right? I mean, if it's true that the court is so beyond ruined now that they would, if not for this younger abstention thingy, be able to rule that it's okay to discriminate, it doesn't give me too much comfort other than it's just going to delay things by like a few months, right? Until there's another case that they find that works better.
Yeah, possibly. Or an even scarier version is they recognize, as Andrew and I were talking about at the beginning, that the facts in this particular case are very, very strong. So they don't want to decide a case where the facts are strongly against redefining the right of religious freedom. And they wait for a better case, at least in their minds, to come along and decide it.
So, okay. So because the facts of this case are so obviously to people like us, favorable toward the fact that this is just discrimination and they shouldn't win, you're saying they punt this one so that they can find one where it's a little more ambiguous, so maybe they have more room to rule for the idea that religious people can do whatever the hell they want.
It's certainly a possibility, and in my mind it militates it more towards
the. But then I'm wondering, so how does this harassment crap factor in? Like, that is just a way they can justify not using this younger abstention if they want to?
And actually deciding the merits of the case.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. It's because that's a
well-established exception. So in other words, right, the idea is you don't evaluate, you don't adjudicate constitutional questions unnecessarily. So, you know, if there's some other way of resolving
something. Unless someone is being mean to you? Why is that an exemption? I don't even understand, I guess. Or an exception.
So why is it an exception to the Younger Doctrine, or why is the...
Yeah, why? Well, you said it's a well-established exception that if somebody's being mean to you, then the Supreme Court... So it's just like...
well, think about it. If this...
How does it work in like real terms when we're not talking about an absurd discriminatory Baker? Like if it's an actual case where it would be useful or make sense to us.
So let me give you a real world example and why they crafted this exemption to the Younger Doctrine. You have a police department that is consistently targeting a particular person, right? And so they have, you know, roughed him up on multiple occasions. They've brought him in on, you know, flimsy charges, and they hold him for the maximum amount of time.
Okay.
You know, and there's just this consistent pattern of, you know, this police department is beating up on this poor guy. And without
this exception. So he goes to file a suit, and then, you know, the Supreme Court would be like, well, you have to go through the proper paperwork of
Exactly, right. And so, and then every time, right, they drop it and then they beat him up again and then they drop it and beat him up again and that sort of thing. Okay. So, you know, so.
And that's exactly what's happening here. With the church.
No, I mean, I'm that's why I'm glad you asked the question that way, right? Because it really underscores Andrew's point that exception is meant to protect, let's put a name and face on it, or at least a category. It is meant to protect African Americans getting brutalized by Southern police departments, right? Like that's where the exception comes from. The idea that, you know, that
which
applies
is exactly
to
the same as the Masterpiece Cake Shop getting a letter or something and having to fill out some paperwork.
Asking it to kindly take part in a mediation to resolve their differences. Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Right. Okay. Well, I understand it a lot better.
First, they came for the cake bakers. Yeah.
I understand it a lot better. First they asked nicely that a cake baker possibly resolve something, and I said nothing. do we want to move on to the Catholic Church? Here?
Yeah. Well, I think unless Andrew is in any way you want to put a bow on this.
Yeah, I will put a bow on it real quick. I will just say that again, the bakery of bigotry does not really deny that it would otherwise make a pink and blue cake, right? You know, this was a birthday cake with color preferences. It does not matter what the customer was doing with it. All that matters is the fact that once she said, this is also going to my gender transition celebration, they said, oops, just kidding, you don't get it. They are clearly, as they were before, rejecting the individual based on a protected trait. So I think it's very clear that this is a rejection of a transgender woman based on that status. That's discrimination. That's illegal. They should lose if this ever gets to the merits, but I'm not sure that it will.
Well said.
Why am I persecuted here?
All right. Well, as bad as we thought that was in terms of using your religion to discriminate, turns out we started with a lighter story in terms of the churches being religious people being awful. Andrew Seidel, talk about this massive report that came out. You wrote a great article about it called It's Time to Quit the Catholic Church. Do you want to give us a quick and dirty, I think people are pretty aware of it, but quick and dirty fact overview here so that we know what we're talking about?
Yeah, so this is the Pennsylvania Grand Jury's report on abuse in the Catholic Church in six of the dioceses there in Pennsylvania. It talked about 300 predatory priests, 1,000 child victims. It stretched to 1,400 pages, the PDF did. They went over more than 2 million documents, including documents from a secret archive that the Catholic Church maintained of these documents relating to abuse. Since the report has come out, or actually in, just in the few days since the report came out, there was, I think, at least 400 new victims came forward and called the hotline that the Pennsylvania Attorney General set up. Wow. And in the report itself, the grand jury said that they believe that the real number of victims, those who were afraid to come forward or where the records were lost, was well into the thousands. So, I mean, you're just talking about just the rape and torture of children on an industrial scale, and then the deliberate cover up of that rape and torture. I mean, the report goes over the 7-stage playbook that the church kept, and that's what they call it, a playbook, kept to cover up this abuse. I read the entire report, and I really, it was very, I don't recommend anybody reading it. I had a very hard time sleeping afterwards. I didn't grow up in the church. I didn't suffer any of this kind of abuse. I had to pull the car over on the way to work the next day. My wife, who's also an attorney here at FFRF, I just was like, I need a minute. And we ended up just talking for 20 minutes on the side of the road, because it is, the details are heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching, the things that happen. And the worst part about it is that they're not really anything new. We've seen reports like this before. We've seen the same kind of abuse happening before. There was a report in 2011 that the John Jay College put out. There was Spotlight 16 years ago. None of this is new. It keeps happening. It's not a surprise. This just happens to be the latest, and it happens to be very well documented. So to me, it's just absolutely clear that you cannot be a thoughtful, compassionate, empathetic human being and be a Catholic at the same time.
And I want to delve into the legal questions. The factual distinction for me in this report, there are a bunch of things, right? So I don't think we knew about the playbook prior to this, right? We knew about secret archives. We knew that the first response was to shuffle priests around and move them geographically. Those are the kinds of allegations that we knew about. We did not know about priests giving crucifix necklaces to kids that they had groomed for abuse as signals to other priests. As far as I know, that's a new fact pattern.
Keep your kids away from the fucking Catholic Church. God, I can't. I don't. How do we deal with it? It's even if you're a Catholic out there, like my family's Catholic. I just hope that they keep their. They don't ever let their kids unsupervised with any of these people.
I don't think that outrage is misplaced. And, part of religion to me is the problem here. And it's what makes this scandal, which is interminable and cyclical, different than a scandal at Penn State or at Michigan State or at a secular charity. Adherents in this religion are primed to accept absurdities. That wine becomes blood, or that crackers become the body of Christ if you mumble the correct words over them. I think I said this in my article, but there's that Voltaire, it's a paraphrase of Voltaire, that those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. Mm, and
yeah,
it's not just those atrocities include sending children back to church or Sunday school or Catholic school, despite knowing that you're delivering them into the arms of a predator, I don't see how that does not happen, but for religion. If this were a secular multinational company that was engaged in this sort of cyclical, industrialized rape and torture of kids and the cover up, they would be boycotted into existence almost immediately. But because it's the church, people treat it differently. And that to me is just, it's insane.
So let's talk about some of the legal implications here. The first that I think people know about is the current existence This is on a state by state level, right? That varies in terms of whether there are statutes of limitation that bar claims that are of a certain age. And I have previously on OA defended in general terms the existence of a statute of limitations, right? It's designed to ensure that evidence is reliable and doesn't degrade, and it is designed to end kind of a cloud over individuals, you know, if you're talking about threatening a breach of contract suit or something like that. But obviously you balance that against the compelling social interests in not allowing somebody to potentially break
the law. Well, yeah, and there's no statute of limitations on murder. I feel like,
right,
you know, child abuse and rape could easily be on that list, is it not?
And so it's not in Pennsylvania. In many states, it's like that. I want to read. This is from page 308 of the report. But the grand jury pleads, this is in their findings section. They say, we think you should abolish statutes of limitation for crimes like this. And here's what the grand jury says. It's not like we're asking for anything that unusual. It turns out that this is the rule in well over half the states across the country. No free pass for the sexual violation of children, no matter how long it has been. That includes almost every state in our region except us being Pennsylvania. If we lived in New Jersey or Delaware or New York or Maryland, we would today be issuing a presentment charging dozens of priests. But because we happen to live here in Pennsylvania instead, the number is 2, not something for Pennsylvanians to be proud of. So I think that one of, you know, I mean, we try on the show to inform and also to have that information lead to some sort of action. I think that the impetus in Pennsylvania and around the country to remove statutes of limitation for child molestation, for child sexual abuse, is really on the upswing.
And I think that's critical. I mean, of the over 300 priests mentioned in that report, only 2 were able to be charged because of the statute of limitations.
Yeah.
And this is something that FFRF has been pushing for and fighting against, along with a number of other groups, including Child. Child health care is a legal duty, an outfit run by the very talented Marcy Hamilton, law professor. She actually brought the city of Bernie v. Flores case way back when. But we are arguing that, you know, for child victims acts, basically, you know, that there should not be statutes of limitations in certain cases, and one of them being the rape and torture of children. The Catholic Church, you know, has spent millions of dollars fighting against these child victims acts. You know, in 2016, we know they spent over $2 million fighting against the one in New York, and Bill Donahue of the Catholic League, who said something along the lines, trying to debunk this report, tried to say that, you know, there wasn't a lot of penetration mentioned in this report, so really those kids weren't raped. That same Bill Donahue said that the New York Child Victims Act was a vindictive bill pushed by lawyers and activists out to rape the Catholic Church, and spent $2 million opposing it. So, you know, there's another option too, because I think, Andrew, you are right, and it's hard to think about the value of statutes of limitations, reading a report like this. But, you know, there's another option too, where you can open a window for 2 or 3 years, a legislative window that says, you know, if you are previously barred by the statute of limitations, you can bring your case in these 2 or 3 years, this window that we are opening up, and, you know, that will... It's basically just a sort of an end around without actually amending the statutes of limitations.
So it solves the problem of making it so that people will still be on edge forever, but also opens it up, you know, to kind of that makes sense as a solution.
It does, but also I think with the grand jury's recommendation, like, right, if you rape kids, I genuinely do not care if you are living on edge forever. That's fine.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
yeah.
I'm okay. I don't think that there needs to be a statute of limitations in these cases, especially when you understand, you know, what this does to the children mentally and emotionally and how long it can take them to even admit in many cases that this happened to them. And then you throw in the religion factor, and that gets exacerbated even more. You know, I mean, there's plenty of documentation in the report about the priests using theology to silence their victims, you know, telling them that they and their mother are going to go to hell if they tell anybody about the, quote, special penance that they were required to do, which included the priests, you know, basically raping the kid. So I don't have that much.
Yeah.
I'm completely fine, actually, I'll say, with the statute of limitations being abolished in those cases.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed.
Well, and one of the efforts to operate in the sphere in which we have a statute of limitations is there was actually a lawsuit filed today. I think there are going to be more to follow. That is one of these victims named in the grand jury report, who is suing the Pittsburgh diocese for the cover up rather than for the actual underlying offense.
Oh,
right. And so the argument is, right, the way in which a statute of limitations works is the clock begins to run from the moment you knew or should have known that you have a particular cause of action, right? And so the argument is, look, we didn't know, right? That this showed that there was a cover up. They were deliberately hiding it from us. We didn't know that there was this cover up prior to this report coming out. And so therefore our cause of action begins to run now, as opposed to begins to run from the date of the assault. Andrew, do you have any thoughts on that as an approach?
I certainly like that as an approach. You know, I mean, it seems to be that the only thing the Catholic Church genuinely cares about is retaining its power, and that means it's money. You know, we've seen them do some really despicable things to avoid paying out, you know, any sort of restitution or recompense to these victims. You know, here in Wisconsin, they took something like $50 million and shifted it. I don't remember the details of it, and shifted it to a cemetery fund, and then so that it wasn't actually in the church, and then the church declared bankruptcy. I'm not getting the facts on that right, but you know, they've done some really, really despicable things, and I think any way that their bank accounts can be hit is worth doing. You know, going after the bishops for child endangerment, we haven't seen a lot of that. I think that is definitely one way that we can kind of get around some of the statutes of limitations in these cases. And I should mention too, you know, if people are out there listening right now and they're thinking, you know, what can I do to help? Again, this is something that FFRF has been working on for quite a while. You should be signed up for FFRF's action alerts. The easiest way to do that is to text FFRF to 52886, and you're automatically signed up for our action alerts, and you'll actually get texts right to your phone when it's a really big deal. If you were a Pennsylvania representative or a Pennsylvania citizen, you already were alerted to our action alert about trying to expand the statutes of limitations, and which legislators are the roadblocks to that expansion, because there are a couple that appear to be in the pocket of the Catholic Church that we are targeting. So one way you can help is by signing up for those action alerts, and then taking the action when we signal it to you. We're also looking at pressuring state's attorney generals all across the country to launch similar investigations to the Pennsylvania investigation, and even maybe something at the federal level, which is what they've done in Ireland and Australia. They have national investigations into the abuse of the Catholic Church. You know, there are 185 dioceses in the United States, and the thousands of victims and the 300-plus priests named in this one are only from six. You know, so you have to multiply it by about 30 to get close to an estimate. And
should we see more reports like this for, you know, are other states going to do this? How did this even start?
Yes, other states are considering launching similar investigations into the the Catholic Church, and we certainly are going to be, when the time is appropriate, and we will send out action alerts and let people know, yes, contact this person, tell them this, it's super easy. You'll be able to email, call, Facebook, and tweet at all the public officials that are worth tweeting, Facebooking, and emailing and calling.
So you Andrew, you jumped ahead to what I wanted to ask, which is, right, how can we help and what can we do? Give the appropriate text again for the action alerts, and then describe what that is, because I know I talk to a lot of people who are nervous about getting involved in politics, and you know, one of the things that I love about having done the show, you know, we get messages every day from people who say, you know, I went to my local town hall and I asked my representative, I asked my senator about Brett Kavanaugh, for example, right? I just had somebody who, you know, spent 3 minutes in, you know, being able to give a presentation in front of her senator. Talk about what getting the action alert does, right? And how it, you kind of help people through that. Because I get that that's scary, right? Like, not everybody is ready to, you know, talk to their representative, talk to their senator, talk to their, you know, governor or what have you. Speak a little
bit. I think that's a good point. It's something I probably forget doing this for a living. But basically, you know, a typical action alert from FFRF will come to your email. If you text FFRF to 52886, you will occasionally get an alert right on your smartphone there. And you will give you a brief explanation of what's going on. So in this case, we'll say, so the statute of limitations in this case is allowing the law only to go after two of the more than 300 priests that were mentioned in this report. That's a big problem. But it's an easy fix if we put some pressure on the legislature. And then we will give you talking points so that you're not going into a phone call or into an email to your legislator completely unarmed. And we will tell you who to contact and what is the best way to contact that person. Usually we try to recommend that people call. That it tends to be more effective than sending an email, which tends in turn to be more effective than using Facebook or other forms of social media. The best thing you could do would be to show up in person at an office and have a meeting. But, you know, if you're scared, you just have to remember two things. One is that these people work for you, right? They are your elected representative. And I have never had an interaction, even with, you know, Ted Cruz's office, that has not been at least polite. So they may disagree with you, but I'd be very surprised if you received rudeness or scorn in return for reaching out and contacting that person. And the second thing is, and this is probably the biggest thing that I hear that is so frustrating, is that, well, you know, my legislator is red, so they're not going to do whatever it is I want them to do, or they're blue, so I don't have to, you know, I don't have to contact them. Nothing could be further from the truth, right? I mean, it is a truism in politics that politicians care about what you think, right? I mean, that's how they keep their job. That is the only thing that they care about. And, you know, for instance, on Brett Kavanaugh, since you used him as an example already, every single senator out there right now is keeping track of every call that comes into their office for or against Kavanaugh. And that is getting reported to the senator at probably the end of the week, saying we got 500 calls for Kavanaugh and 500 calls against. You know, and if that balance shifts one way or the other, it can have a big impact. Now, you might not change that senator's vote, for instance, but you might prevent that senator from going out and whipping up a bunch of other votes, or talking about why Kavanaugh should be confirmed, or you know, going out and behind the scenes, sort of, I should say what whipping votes means, because people may not know, you know, going out behind the scenes and pushing other senators to vote a certain way. Or they might just simply stop talking about it. You could have an actual impact that is not necessarily changing that person's vote. But it's certainly possible to do with enough voices speaking up, because, again, politicians care what you think. I don't know how else to say that.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I'm really glad you walked everybody through that. And again, you know, it's part of what we're trying to do on the show is not just, you know, have the, you know, funereal death march of bad news every week, but try and help folks be able to do something about it. And this is an area where we absolutely can do things about it.
Absolutely. I'm signing up for those alerts. Of course, I'm already an FFRF member, but I don't think I was on those alerts yet. I'm going to do it right now.
I was going to say, I literally pulled out my phone while you were talking, Andrew. So you got two more signups for the alerts.
Well, I hope everybody does that. And that system is actually really phenomenal because, you know, it goes right to your smartphone. You'll get a text and it says, you know, urgent, call your senators about Brett Kavanaugh. We'll use him again as an example because we just found this out. And you actually can do everything right from your smartphone. You can send the email. It's just a couple clicks. You can tweet at your senator, just a couple clicks. Or you can call right through to the senator's office on that system. So that's a really effective way to be sort of a citizen lobbyist. And then you can also sign up through FFRF's website. There's an action alerts tab at FFRF.org, you know, if you're uncomfortable giving out your cell phone number, but it's very easy to do that. And I highly, highly recommend that everybody do it. It makes being an effective advocate for state church separation really, really easy.
Absolutely. That's great advice. I'm so glad we have something, you know, we can do to kind of be on the bright side there. But also, if we happen to have any, I don't know how many Catholic people we have listening, but please do not let your kids be alone with a Catholic priest. It's just, honestly, it's not worth it. And by the way, if you are still giving money to the Catholic Church, this is what you're funding. You're funding a playbook of how to cover this up, of how to move money around so that the people don't have access to it. Please do not give your money to the Catholic Church. Sign up for the FFRF alerts there. All good messages.
Yeah, and I mean, I think your point there, Thomas, is really good. You know, at this point in time, if you still consider yourself a Catholic and still give your time and money to that organization, you are complicit in the rape and the cover-up. There's just no way around it at this point. We know this has happened before. We know it's going to happen again. I mean, the Pope has made that clear by saying that the only thing we need to do to change this is fast and pray. You know, this is not going to change because this problem is inherent in the structure of the church. You know, it is going to happen again. If you continue to support the Catholic Church, you are complicit. And, you know, if that sounds harsh, think about the kids instead.
Good message. Thanks again. We're out of time, but thanks again, as always, for coming on, being the Steve Martin of the show. As I said, we're going to have to, we got lots of jackets to make, Andrew.
Yeah.
Torres. Do you do any sewing, Andrew, or maybe we'll hire that out. I don't know. One way or the other, we got jackets to make.
I've got these silk robes in mind that are, you know, kind of like a half smoking jacket kind of thing.
Yes, that's what I want.
Andrew and Randall are going to like it. I promise.
All right. Well, that's it for the Catholic Church. it would be nice if that was it for the Catholic Church as an organization as well. But that's what you can do to try to do something about this. All right. It is time to thank our top patrons over at patreon.com/law. Thank you guys so much. And by the way, we had a huge, huge outpouring as a result of last week. And we can't thank you enough. We're really excited. We can't wait to make that contribution to Swing Left. You know, it has been a catharsis to have things that we can do, like FFRF and like donating and all that stuff, you know, at a time where it feels pretty helpless. But at any rate, we've got top patrons to thank, and they're going to enjoy, of course, a lot of awful movies in the Q&A.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, who are our top patrons that we need to thank this week?
Our top patrons, thank you, too. Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. I listen to OA at the direction of the candidate. The other Michael Cohen. The Getting Off Podcast. Out on Vacation. Mike the Intactivist. Rob Schreck. Pecker Protected Papers. Proving Puppet Piped Plenty. Peggy Petersons.
Nice.
Anonymous. Dale and Lee Samus Grix. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. Put Your Analyst on Danger Money, Baby. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Bob Estalela, Van Lingomungo, Huggy Bergamo, Sigmund Jakuki. All right. Matthew Vernon, Randy Bugger, Magrathea was a capitalist utopia. Very true. Healing Elementals on Etsy, promo code OpenArgs for 10% off. Sam, Milo Headsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU 3L. Join your labor union. Notus gratis. POTUS chose us to bogus. Chota. POTUS chose us bogus. SCOTUS zealots. Nice. Matt, the liberal cat. Starry decisis from the top rope, brother. Good WWE reference there. David Satz. Tears of pain are in the eye of the beholder. Brian Upshaw's last chance for-profit prison. But lady, I'm flying a spaceship. Buttercup's polyphony services, actual yodeling advice from an actual cat. Torturing you until it's said correctly, Dr. Bergeris. We'll find out if I've done that. Another Two Live Crew reference. He's not a war hero. I like people that weren't captured. Dash asshole. Two top patrons just got engaged. Yeah, I know. We're still celebrating here.
Yeah.
If I shave my eyebrows, it will make my alternate timeline goatee. Needs a new Patreon name in a hurry. Yeah, you missed it. Skid Row said 18 in life. Badass song. But I guess 8 will do. Keith Davies. Dave, stop using my Patreon to make Andrew say things. Everything that guy said was bullshit. Thank you, the Manafort defense team. And finally, Saul. Thank you all so much. And Thomas, you've got your half.
And thank you to There's Always Room for More Experts, Big Easy Blasphemy, A String of Unpronounceable Characters, Legalize the Purge, A Real Star Wars Fan. Nice. Nothing is worse than a monster who thinks he's right with God. Oof, theme of today's show. Am I being impeached, officer? Cancel the world's scariest, most hilarious reality show in 2020. Rhonda the Baked Alaskan. Malika Chandler. Hotspots on my dog. Soggy Pants. CampQuest.org. 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 Sam Dinow. Greg Sullivan. I'm not creative enough to increase my pledge for philosophers in space. Sure you are. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Aaron Grady. Another Cohen Bites the Dust. The Wayward Willis Podcast, Ian and Allie, St. Muller, Patron Saint of Yodelers, Jim Grove, Eli Bosnick, Cooking Heath with Ramen, Carl Carlson, and Lenny Leonard. I hereby promise to make a yodel video wearing only lederhosen. Is that for me? I guess it's for, okay. I, Thomas, will finally watch the Brat Pack canon. Oh, okay. Are those
That's a great
80s,
yeah,
90s
yeah.
movies or something? Yeah, 80s, yeah no, I haven't seen like yeah. any of them.
We're going to start off. You and I, we're going to cuddle up and we're going to watch The Breakfast Club together.
3D print Super Soakers instead. Brian, Robot in Disguise. Zegantron, More Than Meets the Eye. Dave, Living Life Yodel Mountain High in Trump's America. Mitchell, By Grafthar's Sickle, Reclaim the Means of Space Production. Good philosophers in space one there. Give Lydia a segment like Lucinda has on Scathing. Stormy Daniels is a legal genius, is the best. Andrew was right. Oh, I totally agree. Ryan Byrne, a grizzled veteran of the War on Info. And finally, our top patron, Conrad Michaels. I don't know if anyone's ever going to catch Conrad Michaels, but you should sure as hell try. Thank you guys so much for making the show happen.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, and now it's time to, I am on a real streak. I don't know if you know this, Andrew Seidel, but I'm on a real hot streak. I think you should be nervous. You should be worried. Yeah, you know, this is gonna be stiff competition.
Me? I'm already a lawyer. I don't have to pass the bar. I'm fine.
No, you just have your pride. Is that stuff?
Oh, no. No, I don't have any of that.
Oh, okay. Never mind then. Okay, then let's just play the game.
Okay, and as always, we do the questions in order from the document. So this was not designed to give our guest an advantage. But Thomas and Andrew, several public high school students asked the superintendent of their public school district whether the minister of a local church could deliver an interdenominational prayer at their graduation ceremony in the school auditorium. None of the students or their guests at graduation would be required to pray while the minister delivered the prayer.
Torres, you're freaking killing me. This is just trying to embarrass me. Like you joke. All right.
Would the minister's delivery of such a prayer at the public high school graduation be constitutional? A. No, because it would be an unconstitutional establishment of religion. B. No, because it would deny attendees who are not members of the minister's denomination the right to freely exercise their religion. C. Yes, because none of the students or their guests would be required to pray at the graduation ceremony. Or D, yes, because the idea for the prayer originated with the students and not with school officials.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait to embarrass myself with this one. Well, they're not requiring any of the students, but I still don't... Let's see, Mr. Interdenominational prayer at the graduation ceremony? I have a hard time believing this wouldn't be constitutional based on our country. Like, it's... Okay, so Pollitt High School asked the superintendent whether the local church can deliver an interdenominational prayer. Now, I don't want this to be what to be constitutional, but I'm wondering if maybe it is. At the graduation ceremony, no one would be required to pray. Ugh. I would love it to be A, no, because it would be an unconstitutional establishment of religion. I would love that. That would be great. But here's the thing. I don't think the yes answers are quite what I'd expect if it were a yes answer. Like, I would expect better yes answers, as in yes, it's constitutional. Because the C and D were yes because none of the students would be required to pray. Well, okay, that could be it. Maybe could be it. Or D, yes, because the idea for prayer originated with the students. I don't think that has anything to do with it. I don't think that possibly would justify an unconstitutional thing as long as the students think of it. But I don't know. Could be wrong. I think not. No on D. So A and B. I want it to be A and B. No, because it would be, No, because it would be an unconstitutional establishment of religion. Or B, no, because it would deny attendees who are not members of the minister's denomination the right to freely exercise their religion. So which would be the better no answer? Would it be just the straight up no as A, or would it be because people who weren't represented wouldn't have the right? You know, I'm just going to hope that I'm going to hope for the best here and say it's A, because it just would be an establishment of religion. I think that the next likely answers are probably B and C. So I'll eliminate D. I don't know. I just hope it's A. I don't even like really any of the other answers, regardless of whether it's constitutional or not. I could see it being C. I don't know. I'm hoping for the best. I'm going with A.
All right. Andrew, what do you think?
The answer is...
All right. Now that I've answered, and now that this is specifically something that Andrew Seidel does for a living, I think it would be kind of ruin the fun if Andrew answers now. So we'll just have Andrew Seidel's answer take place on Tuesday's episode so that people can still play along. So go ahead and play along. See if you think I got it right. Maybe I didn't. We'll find out with answer key Andrew Seidel on Tuesday's episode. All right. Well, that's our show. Thank you so much, Andrew Seidel, for coming on. It really is a pleasure every time. And I hope there are many more times, although it'd be nice if we could cover something a little less horrifying. But what can we do about that? Well, we tell you, sign up for text alerts. That's what we can do about that. And of course, thank you for listening. Thank you to everybody who supports the show and makes it happen. And we'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.